Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together, whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.
Hello and welcome to another episode of My Property World. I'm delighted to be joined by Paul Ribbons. Great to have you back on, Paul.
How you doing, Will? Thank you very much for inviting me again.
So Paul is a legendary property trader. He's been in the property game for decades. The number of deals he's been involved with, which have been completed, must be getting up into close to 1,000 at this stage. Is that right, Paul?
It certainly is, yeah. Certainly been involved in a lot of deals, yeah.
And we've had Paul on the show a number of times with episodes about trading, about his own background. He's got a fantastic backstory. But we're doing a series at the moment on, I suppose, mental skills and mental health. We call the Resilience Series. And the Resilience Series today is going to be focusing on the topic of worry and how to turn worry into an opportunity. So, Paul, without too much further ado, and I did say people should know how to get hold of you. How should they get hold of you before we get going?
They can connect with me on Facebook, Paul Ribbons, or they can email me, paul@paulribbons.com, if they wish to. I've also got a YouTube channel, Paul Ribbons. If you search YouTube, you'll find me, and you can subscribe there if need be, because we'll be doing a lot of content in the future. And I also put these podcasts up on YouTube as well, so if people want to see the visual, they can do.
The video version, absolutely. Yeah. You might be watching one now, so... It's great to have you on, Paul. So, worry, turning it into an opportunity. How does that work? What is worry, firstly, is probably a good starting point. We were talking around this before we started recording, and I hope you had some interesting points.
Yeah, certainly. It's funny because we were talking off camera, and he was asking me how do you stop worrying and what it's about, and you mentioned a few things that, you know, that you worried about. But I see worry very similar to pain. And if you think about pain, if you was to stumble over and break your leg, what would happen? Immediately you'd have this raging pain in your leg. Your body would start releasing chemicals like adrenaline and painkillers to try and ease the pain, so you can get where you need to go to try and rest somewhere. And what is that? What is pain? What is, if you think about it logically, what is it? And it's a message coming from the broken part of your leg or whatever you're hurting. It's a message to your brain to say, keep off. Because we think of doctors and hospitals, that we go there and we get mended by the doctors or the hospitals, but actually your body is a fantastic bit of kit, and it then goes into a repair mode. So once the hospital's set your leg, it's not the doctors that repair your leg, it's your own body repairing. So when does the pain subside? Well, the pain subsides when the wound is healed. So all of a sudden, you're walking around, you don't even think about the pain anymore. Your leg's healed and you're running around like normal. And worry is very similar to pain. It's just a message. Now, what I hear many, many times is, I'm worried about you know, the economy. I'm worried about, you know, my kids. I'm worried about, you know, my finances. There's all sorts of things that people worry about, and we'll be touching on them as we go along. But if we think about it from another perspective, if you think of all the things you've ever worried about, 95% of them have never happened. Never. You've worried about this, that, and the other. You blow it out of all proportion in your mind about worrying about your kids when they're out enjoying themselves, or, you know, it might be a deal that you're doing. And this is the thing. How many times has something happened? You never worried about it. Something big happened in your life. But what happened? You just got on with it, didn't you? You think about it, you just got on with it. This is what we do. We are presented with a problem. We just then find a solution and move on. Some of us are better at solution than others. But it's something we just have to deal with. It's presented to us. We've got no choice. It's there in front of us. What do we do? Okay, fair enough. We'll just get on with it. We'll do this. And you might ask yourself a series of questions. So when we know what worry is, it's just a message to the brain. I need to pay attention to this, right? Now, whether that may be, let's take, for instance, you know, I'm a bit worried about having a car crash. I mean, some people worry about crashing their cars. Why would you worry about that? Yeah, you've got a reason to be worried. There's a lot of lunatics out there. But actually, the amount of journeys that are traveled and the amount of accidents that happen is actually the percentage is very, 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 very low. Very low. And if you think
I imagine that those accidents that someone actually is seriously hurt is pretty low again.
Yeah, it's percentage-wise, yeah. But actually, percentage of accidents and serious injuries
versus total car journeys.
Because you can have a ding in your car and not have a serious accident, but you still have an accident.
Although some people worry about that a lot.
They do. And this is the thing, right? You're traveling down a road. And I want people to understand this. You're traveling down a road and there's a broken white line between this side of the road and that side of the road. And there's someone driving the other side, the other direction, on the other side of the road, keeping that their side of that white line. You don't even know them, but you've got complete trust in them, but they're not going to come over to your side and smash into your car. But you'll be driving along without even consciously thinking about that driver is going to stay that side of the road. Complete trust in them.
You obviously haven't been driving in Fiji.
but we're talking about, we don't realize how many journeys do we make each week? How many people do we pass? How many people are on the road? Yes, we see one. We might shout at them. Someone cuts us up or whatever. But 95% of the people on the road are behaving themselves and actually being very respectful. And we worry about this, and we got, and yes, there are things to be concerned about, but as long as you're doing the right thing, you're prepared yourself. And I used to ride a motorbike, and my girlfriend at the time used to worry about me riding the motorbike. And I used to say to her, look, you haven't got to worry about me. I just got to worry about the other lunatics on the road. So all I've got to do is treat everyone like a lunatic, expect them to pull out on me. So therefore, I'll anticipate just in case they do. So that was my preparation for not worrying about getting knocked off my bike. Same with my push bike. I ride my push bike. My wife worries about me riding my push bike. And I say, look, I've just got to be careful and treat everyone, you know, one, with respect and consideration, but also to expect the worst. And then if I expect the worst and nothing happens, then I've had a result. I don't worry about it. I just make sure that I'm anticipating coming up to a junction. Will they pull out? I'm anticipating a car behind me on a country lane. I'm going to pull over, let him go past because he might try and overtake, or they might try and overtake me, a risky bend or something like that nature. So it's understanding that you've got a certain amount of control over things, and as long as you're making the sensible decisions, then you've got absolutely nothing to worry about. Makes sense.
It does. And the different types of worries that that you've mentioned a few of them. Around money, around fear of failure, around what's going on in the economy, what's happening to the value of property that I may have brought, or that the cost of financing property I haven't brought yet is a very common one. And what people might think of me is another common one.
There's a few there. You're throwing at me there all at once. Let's deal with a few of them at the front end then. So them front ends were people worried about money or the economy generally. And that reminds me of a friend of mine who was really concerned. Right, he opened his estate agents in 2008. Right, you remember 2008? It was a terrible time. And within that, over the course of the next 12 months, he used to ring me up regularly going, I'm really worried. I said, what are you worried about? He said, I'm really worried. I'm going to run out of money. I said, have you got any money in the bank right now? He's going, yeah, I've got money. I'm worried about it. I'm going to run out. I said, okay, so what can you do about it? He said, well, I can't do anything. If we can't sell houses, we can't do it. I said, what's another way? His estate agents was fairly new, and he was a sales agent. And I said, what other areas can you go into that you could overcome?
What other services? Yeah.
Other services. So he said to me, well, nothing. Because mortgages are linked up with house sales and solicitors' recommendations are linked. Mm-hmm. What else can you do, Mark? What else? Mm-hmm. And he sat there thinking, and he went, I suppose I could let a few. I said, if people aren't selling, what are they going to do? They might let. And there was a lot of accidental landlords created during that time. And guess mm-hmm. what he did? He survived it. And guess what he did? He never ran out of money, right? He never ran out of money. He got close a couple of times, right? Really close. I said, you worry about this, but don't worry about it until it actually happens. And when it actually happens, then you can deal with it, right? So, yeah, but if I worry, it's okay. What can you do about it? And that's the key to worry, right? So we think about worry, and we think about, so what can I do about worrying? So with Mark, you know, what's the worry, the concern? I'm going to worry, run out of money. Okay, so therefore, what can you do about it? What other things can you consider? Which he did. He went into lettings. And then as long as he's doing everything he possibly can, and if necessary, put things into place, because just as I mentioned earlier, worry is like a message to the brain. It's like pain. It's telling you, I need to be concerned about it. I need to be aware of what's going on. It's a coping mechanism. It's a going back to
there's a sports psychology analogy around appropriate focus, where you can focus internally, mm-hmm. Like so inside your body, how you're feeling, mm-hmm. Or outside, like what's going on outside, mm-hmm. and you can have a narrow focus or a broad focus, and that can be the same both internally or externally. Yeah. And what the appropriate focus at a given time is. And their example would be, while the ball's flying through the air towards you, thinking, I've got a sore foot is not really a good appropriate focus. you're better off waiting until play stops to notice that you have a sore foot.
Yeah, no, that's a very, very good point. Your focus is going to be very specific, and that's asking yourself the right questions: is what can I do about this? What do I need to be doing about it? Also, there's a little trick I can give people, right? So if someone's particularly worried, so that's an emotional response, right? And your physiology can make a big difference to the outcome of you worry.
What do you mean physiology, Paul?
Physiology, so the way you use your body. Okay, so if I said to you, if you looked at a depressed man, before you even looked at him, what do you think he would be doing?
He'd be slumped over, head down.
There you go.
You know, his head would be in his hands. He'd be scratching, scratching a hole in the, his scalp, basically.
That's it. So if I ask you to be on door number two, is would be someone worrying, what are they going to be doing?
So, sorry, you cut out there.
Behind door number two, mm-hmm. someone who's going to be worrying, what do you think they're going to be looking like?
They're going to be fretful. They're going to be heads going to be shaking back and forth, fidgety.
So that's physiology is, you're hyped up. And, So if we understand that it's a physical response, then we ask ourselves, okay, so where in my body am I feeling this worry? And most people will probably go here or around their abdomen somewhere. And I ask them the question, so does it move? Does it move? Well, yeah, it might be going up or it might be going, wherever it's moving. And I ask them to spin it round, right? To spin it round, get it faster, and pull it outside of their body and then flick it round the other way, spin it round the other way, and then put it back in your body. And then that feeling goes away. It's a really simple technique. Or there's another technique you can use. You can use what I call, it's the guy who told me it's called one point, which is put all your energy into your core. And then think about your
one. And what do you mean put your energy into your core?
Imagine just holding your core. Your core is, in your abdomen, right? And concentrate all your energy as if all your energy is going into that place.
Breathing. So that's where all your breath, your focus, your muscle tension, your focus, everything is going.
Everything
in there.
Focus on that core. Breathe deeply, and then
some of us have bigger cores than others.
I'm sure we do. So once you concentrate on your core, or you've got rid of that, or you've changed that feeling, then you can look at that problem in a different way, and. I like to, this is really important. The power of language. So you'll hear me use words like issue or challenge, not problem or nightmares. The language that people use. So if I had something I was worrying about, and it's a problem, right? Or it's a fucking nightmare. If you change the word that you use for that issue and call it issue or something with less emotional charge, then the feelings dissipate. Because I'll give an example of what I mean. What's the word that you would use when you get angry and you get really wound up? What's the word you use? I mean, it might be a swear word, but what's the word? What's the place you go? You'll go, I'm off, or what's the word you use?
Like for fuck's sake would probably be the, it's not a single word, but
yes, for fuck's sake. Oh, you're there, right?
Yeah.
So would you
excuse the language to the listeners?
But so that, give me are you fucked off, or are you pissed off, or what would be the, I know for fuck's sake, but what would be the actual?
The feeling, maybe seething.
Seething, right?
Yeah.
Change the word to I'm peed off.
Look what I'm laughing already. Just like that. Change your word and you change how you're feeling.
Exactly.
You change your focus, you change how you're feeling.
So it's changed the language you use, because what happens is when you get, when you're seething, when you say, for fuck's sake, you've stored all them times when you've been seething in the same place. But you've got a reference point.
And that word, it consumes you. Just literally, even thinking about the word, changes my physiology.
Yeah.
So
because you've got no reference point for peed off, right? So you haven't got this big amount of experiences that you've put in the same place, and you go to that place every time you get seeding, right? Peed off. So you start laughing. So changing the language that you use is so powerful when it comes to worry. So instead of worrying about, I'm worried about it. So I'm concerned about it. Now I want you to say, I'm worried about something, or I'm concerned about it. Say that now to yourself and see how different it feels.
I'm really worried about X. Yeah, I can feel that, like actually in my scalp.
Yeah.
You know,
now
I'm really concerned about this. It feels quite calm, actually.
It's calming, yeah.
Rational, logical. Rational.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because
it's taking the emotion out of it, basically.
It's two things that I'm very, very. It stood me in good stead for all my life, and I installed it into my kids, and I'm very rational and very logical on any issues that I have in front of me, because if you come from a place of high emotion or, you know, emotionally charged language, it's very difficult to deal with things. It's a lot more difficult. So if you take the charge out of it, the emotional charge out of it, so as soon as you've got a concern, so you've got a concern about your daughter going to wherever or wherever the case may be, it's a completely different scenario. And then you can think about it logically and you can deal with it rationally. And then you realize, actually, I'm being irrational about this because I'm emotionally charged. So that's a good way of dealing with it. Is using the different types of language, and it's catching yourself doing it, right?
And so you identify that you've got this worry, you've got this concern, and it might be about what's going on in the wider market. What does this mean for my retirement? What does this mean for my plan that was it was so great 12 months ago, and it's not so great now? What's the process one then applies? Like, since you've given us a couple of little tools in terms of putting the focus on your core, and then secondly, you know, examining the language and changing the language. But what would be some of the other tools or processes that you would apply?
So once you've changed the language, I've got this massive problem with me and my pension pot or the investments, and they're all going to go tits up, and I'm worried about it. And so you've changed the language. Actually, I'm a little bit concerned about the market and how it's going to affect my retirement. Okay, so now we've got a different language, right? So now we're looking at it from a slightly different perspective. So what can I do about it? Actually, nothing. Right this minute, there's nothing you can do about it. But what can I do to avert a potential issue? Is the market going to crash? Is it? So we look at market indicators. We look at the wider picture and also the broader market. So when I talk about the broader market, if I go back to when I first started in property in 1986, I remember predicting house prices would be in their hundreds of thousands, not their tens of thousands. And everyone thought I was bonkers at the time, because it was the 1980s. You could buy a house for 40, 50 grand, right? But I could see what was going to go on. And you could see that every so often house prices would double, regardless of inflation and stuff like that, because, you know, just things expand, the economy. And during that period from 1986 to 2003, I've seen some really horrendous things and some really good things. But overall, over that 30-odd year period, mostly the market's been up. Mostly. It dips. There can be bigger dips than others. So we do know, if you're going to retire, how old are you now?
49.
So when are you going to retire?
No plans to retire at all. When I can't work, I'm enjoying what I'm doing.
Let's assume that you're going to dip into your pension pot by the time you get to 70, right?
Sure.
So you've got 21 years. I can guarantee you there'll be two recessions in that time. Guarantee it.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have two dips, but you're going to have a lot more ups than dips.
Mm-hmm.
So if we know that, so what do I need to do with my portfolio? What do I need to do by investments? What do I need to do in order to avert a big crash? Well, you could do one of two things. I've seen this happen with many people. They sell the high and buy the dip. So you can offload some of them now and then wait for them to come down. That's a risky strategy unless you really know what you're doing, because I don't think we're going to see that much of a massive dip in the immediate future. And that's a podcast for another time, right? So if we start looking at it, that we know these things are going to happen, we know the whole market is cyclical, it's a cycle, right? So we do know that, and we only have to look back at history to see that is the case. So in 21 years, as long as you've bought something sensible and you've protected yourself from any real shock. So I was talking to someone yesterday, used to put all her mortgages on 10 years and everyone thought she was bananas. Well, she's really proved herself now because she's got fixed rate 10-year mortgages at 3.8%. And now people who are remortgaging now.
You're getting arrangement fees of 3.8%.
But she's sitting pretty now. She knows, and she said, I know what my payments are going to be for 10 years. They're not going to change in that 10 years. So It's about forward planning. If anyone is sitting there thinking, well, you know, I'm having a shock to the system, they didn't prepare in the first place. Because if you took a mortgage out 2 years ago with a rate at 1.9%, anyone with a brain would have known that interest rates were going to go up, right? We knew that. Everyone knew that. So we should have prepared for it. Does that make sense? If you haven't and you're sitting there thinking, oh, shit, what do I do now? Then you need to adjust and see which ones are working, which ones aren't working, because some of your portfolio is going to be potentially negative or looking not as good as it did before. Well, there's other opportunities that you can do. You can perhaps sell that one that's not so good and then buy something that's better or change as different strategies. So it's understanding what I just said to Mark when E-term managers are going to run out of money. You know, start looking at what you can do about it. Because once you take that emotional charge out, you've changed your language, you're seeing it from a different perspective. We know it's a message that we need to pay attention to. What can I do about it? I've made some decisions. Now I go and implement them decisions. And then you should be able to then relax. If you're still getting worried, it could be something deeper than that. And you need to ask yourself the question, okay, so what haven't I thought about? Because if you have taken that emotional charge out, you've changed the language, you've seen it from, you know, for what it is, because that's another thing as well, is acceptance, right? Sometimes if something is occurring and it's bringing that worry closer to you because you're seeing it happening in front of you and going, well, it's actually going to affect me and it's coming closer and closer and closer. It's accepting that this is going to happen. I know interest rates are going to rise. I know we're going to have to pay more money. We've got one of our fixed rates coming off in the next 6 months, and it's going to be substantially higher than it was before. But if I'd have said to you, Will, in September last year, in fact, I might have said it to you. I certainly said it to John Cox. You saw interest rates literally all get pulled off the market. Do you remember that month when all the lenders pulled their rates? And they went from
interest rates that there was no lending.
No, they just pulled all their rates and then put new rates back up again, which was like 6%, 6.5%. And everyone's going, hoo-hoo-hoo! And I said to John, don't worry, by February, they'll be down to a sensible level. Because all they did was panic, which was, we don't know where the base rate's going to go. So they've made a decision. We don't want to lend the money at a loss. So you might as well pull all our rates back up. And their strategy was quite straightforward. Bung a load of rates on so we got products to sell and then adjust them later when we know what the interest rate's going to do. So now we're at the peak of inflation. We've already gone through peak inflation. It's coming down now. We know interest rates have stabilized. And now we can start planning a bit more. With a bit more certainty than we did back in September.
So just going back to this point of what can I do about it? So you've identified what you think is the root cause of your worry. What's causing your concern? Just to use your change of language. What's a good methodology for selecting what you can do about it? Because
research. Yeah,
these days there's so many, you know, conflicting bits of advice and different strategies, and there's always been different strategies and always different bits of advice. But something you were talking about before the show is how the world's changed substantially, particularly around communications and the availability of news, of information, of ever increasing degrees of complexity.
Yeah.
How do you strip through all of that and get to make a decision? Because the there becomes another layer of worry around procrastination. And the procrastination becomes like this endless loop where you're assessing one strategy, you're thinking about option A, B, C, and D, and at some point you've got to pick something.
I'm going to give you two examples of that that have been very real and forced upon us. All right. So I'm going to go back to 2020. We've coming out of 2019 with optimism. The Roaring Twenties was being branded around, and we're leaving the European Union in December 2019, and everything looks stable and fantastic. And then we are coming into 2020. And this is really important to understand, right? So I predicted house prices jumping in 2020, 2021, in 2022. And there was a reason for that. And we have to apply logic to anything. So I'll give you the reason in a minute, which I'll make sure I come back to, the reason why I thought we was going to get a boom. But what interrupted that was in January 2020, I saw a newsreel about a virus in Wuhan. And the World Health Authority had issued a concern, right, that this could get out and cause a global pandemic. And everyone thought, oh, here we go, to take the notice. And I paid attention to it, and I thought, okay, so I'll look into I'll do a bit of research. And this is where the world has changed, right? I can go and get a blog today, or I can go and get a YouTube channel, and I can spout off whatever I want. And unless it's hate speech or it's a conspiracy theory against the government, it will stay up there. Right. And it'd be my opinion. And I could have no basis for that opinion whatsoever. So I hear people talk about, well, I saw it on Facebook. OK, so who said it? Who said what you said? Yeah. Well, I saw it on the Internet. OK, so where did you see it? And this comes to my point, is that when I started to be concerned about coronavirus, I did a search on three things. Right. One was virology and viruses, and I looked back at Spanish flu, did the research, and looked at sites where they were credible. And this is really important. If you're worrying about shit and you need to get information, you need to do research. So you're now concerned because you've taken the worry out of it. So I'm concerned about it. I need to go and get some information. Make sure the information you'll get is credible. And the way you do that is, just because you see it on the internet doesn't mean to say it's right. So you need to look a bit further. So I got my information from the Harvard Medical website. Now, Harvard, do we trust Harvard? Would you trust?
By and large, yes.
Right?
Academically, it would be well regarded.
It's well regarded. So any information that's coming out of Harvard would be a trustworthy place to go and look for your information. So I was getting my information from the Harvard website about virology. I was getting my information about Spanish flu from past records, right? Actual numbers, because there was actually a lot of uncertainty around the numbers during that time and what happened to Spanish flu. But what was more important is what was going on in the world and how they dealt with it. So they were doing social distancing. But they didn't have any vaccinations. So my next search was vaccinations, because how many people were worried, right, about how can you produce a vaccine so quickly? It takes years, doesn't it, to get a vaccine? Normally, you haven't got the world that works together and chucked everything, including the kitchen sink, at trying to get the answer. And every single pharmaceutical company had open source. So whereas normally they'd protect it because they'd want to protect their rights on their product, everyone had access to all the information, so they could all, and also we cracked the code for DNA, so we got that information quite quickly. So we could, so again, it's getting information in the correct manner. So in 2020, I was concerned this virus could cause us a problem. It then hit Italy in the end of January, early Feb, and we saw literally queues of people lining up in hospital corridors on stretchers, on beds, no ventilation equipment. So you could then predict what was going to happen. So if France, Austria, Italy were being hit, Spain was being hit before us, well, they're going to nick all the PPE equipment, aren't they? Then we're going to have, our government's going to rush in to start producing PPE. And they, so we could see what was happening in Italy. We could see what's happening in France. No one was paying any attention what the governments were doing. They were complaining, you know, showing pictures of, oh, my word, so many are dead, so many have caught it. But I wanted to know what the French were doing about shutting their economy down and how they were getting money to people and how the Italians were doing it and how the Spanish were doing it, because that would give us an indication what our government was going to do. We could then start predicting that if they were going to lock our economies down or lock, you know, put us into lockdown, they were going to have to throw money at the problem. So we could then predict that we're going to get locked down because it's already hit our shores by end of February. So we knew it was and again, we was looking at the numbers, the R rate. You remember the R rate? They got it down to below one. Well, the R rate to
how
start
quickly it spread, yeah.
It was 8 originally, right? And they got it down to 1, right? Which is still bad, but, you know, it's not going to be as bad as 8, right? And we could see that this was going to be affecting us. And I'd already worked out, okay, so what do we need to do? This could cause a recession, because if everyone contracts, if everyone was going to do, and I thought, well, actually, the government are going to throw money at this problem. Let's watch out how this plays out. I'm not going to buy any houses in the interim period. The two I've got in auction, I'm just going to let go. I don't care if I lose a few quid on them, because I don't really want to hold them right this moment. So there was two in the auction, and I think we lost 15 grand on a pair of them. I wasn't bothered about that, because I didn't want to be holding anything at that moment in time. Agreed. I went back and said, look, I'm not going to buy it, but if you want to give it, if you do want me to buy it today, I will buy it, but it's going to be 20% lower than what I was paying. So I was preparing for the worst. And when you prepare for the worst, then anything other than the worst is a good result. And I always look at things and think, can we live with this? What can we live with? What's it going to be? What's the downside for me? And can I live with that downside? Can I accept that? And once you accept the scenario that this is going to be uncertain for a while, we realized once we got shut down, they started throwing money at the economy. They started throwing money at business, and they started making sure that people are functioning. Yes, they got it wrong sometimes, but overall they got it right. They got that vaccination program. We were one of the best countries to come out of lockdown. Everyone slags off our government, but our government, apart from Israel, were the first out of lockdown, the first ones to vaccinate all our population. We were the first ones out of the blocks. The rest of the world was looking in, watching us. Anyway, so I wanted to find out what was going to happen with auctions, and we saw this whole new transformation of going online. So I avoided that first auction deliberately to see what happened. And so I was planning ahead, getting information from the correct places to see what was going to go on. I was looking at that auction, and then I had different, as a trader, I've got different data points now. People couldn't view houses, but they were watching the video on YouTube. How many people viewed the YouTube video was giving me an indication of how many people like turn up to view the house. So there was a lot of views on one of our houses. How many people had downloaded the legal packs? Now, in the old days, you could turn up at an auction, you registered to bid, but you didn't have that information prior to the auction coming. So I could now go to the auctioneer and say, how many people have registered to bid for our lot? 20. Oh, okay. We wouldn't know that in a normal auction. If the auction room was packed, we'd probably have a good day. If it was really quiet, you'd have a bad day. Now you had different data points. So it gave me more information and more detailed information. So it's not, it's very similar to you'd see Facebook adverts, right? And everyone slags off Facebook for selling your data. But if you do a campaign on Facebook, you can literally state, I want men of a certain age, of a certain demographic. You can pinpoint location, an area, yeah. Right? So you could, so if you've got an audience that small, you'd pay more for the advertising because you've got a bigger focus, or a more focused
segment
to sell to. So I knew then my data points were actually more favorable to me now because we're digitalized, mm-hmm. and we could see how many people were watching the auction, and we could tell, of course, I could see which person was bidding, you know, it'd have an initial next to it, how many times they'd bid. So it was a whole new ball game, but I had no need to worry about it. I was just concerned. So do you see how we can turn a complete nightmare into a situation where there was, and this is what we did, right? Once we realized what was going to go on, we filled our boots. We bought loads of properties without seeing them. We were just going, yes, we'll have it. We'll make an offer of that. Yes, we'll have it. Yes, we'll have it. When everyone else was sitting on the fence, I was buying. And we were buying some absolute crackers. And they went to auction over the next 6 months, 9 months. It took us a while to buy them because everything was suppressed. Everyone was working from home. It was difficult to get searches. It was more difficult to purchase. But once we come out the other side and the stamp duty changes, we had a market to sell into. And here's the thing I was going to mention earlier. I knew that the market was going to go ballistic in 2020, regardless of the pandemic or not. And the reason I knew that is what happened prior to the pandemic that affected property.
So Brexit would commonly
a referendum in 2016 affected what people were doing. So they sat on the fence. So the numbers for transactions dramatically reduced between 2016 and 2019. And people put their purchasing plans on hold.
Plans.
And so once they've gone, we knew what was doing and we knew this was done and everyone went, oh, goodness for that. We knew there was going to be a mini boom of people coming in who had been sitting on the fence for the last 3 years. And they were going to be buying houses. And that coincided with stamp duty being changed, the pandemic not being as bad as what people thought it was going to be as far as the economy is concerned. And then this deluge of buyers that came out of the woodwork to buy houses. So we armed with the right information, it could have been deemed as, oh my God, this is, I'm so worried about it. So actually, wow, I'm a bit concerned, but let's look at the information first, then build a picture and then act upon it. And then we take advantage of that.
And so that understanding the situation turns worry into an opportunity, really.
Completely, absolutely. And we did the same thing in 2008. And I'll give you an example of 2008. In the early 2008, I bought a house in Gilliam in a road called Gilliam Road, and the house cost us Ingram Road, Gilliam, and the house cost us £100,000, and it was a banger. It's typical what we buy, absolute horrible, stinky, smelly one, and we was selling it into the market when interest rates had just chipped up to 5.75%. And the banks were going into a bit of a turmoil in September 2008. And we were selling it into that market and we didn't get great money for it. It made 115 grand. So profit to us was minimal, really, after all our costs. I think we made about seven grand on it. And I thought, wow, that I was expecting that to sell for 125, 130, but there was a lot of uncertainty. And then all of a sudden, all hell let loose. The markets crashed. The stock markets crashed. Lehman Brothers went bankrupt that year. And then you had the credit crunch, right? So we was in a situation where, again, we haven't got a clue what's going to go on. All I did know was, if people can't buy houses, they can't borrow money, they can't buy houses, we've got to be very, very careful. And I was watching a YouTube video by a guy called Warren Buffett. And he turned around and said, be fearful when people are greedy and be greedy when people are fearful. And when the market starts wobbling, buy at 40% below perceived value. He didn't say 40% below the value, perceived value. So if someone perceives the value, so that house I bought in Ingram Road was 100 grand, the perceived value is 115,000, because it had sold at that, right? They buy 40% below it. 40% is a lot. That's a lot. But when there's no money around, that's an opportunity. But you've got to get your timing right, because if you buy them all at the wrong time, you've paid money for them and you want to keep them, or you're trying to fund them, it's going to be very difficult to fund them. But what did happen during that period? And we saw it happen right in front of our eyes. The governments of the world stepped in. The Bank of England stepped into this country and produced £375 billion worth of quantitative easing. And they pumped that money into the system. The governments backed the banks and bought out certain banks, privatized them and bought them into the fold. So they didn't fail. They didn't want any banks to fail, apart from Lehman Brothers. No banks failed. They got swallowed up by other banks. They got passed off. People were panicking and thinking, look what happened to Northern Rock. They were taking their money out of Northern Rock because they thought Northern Rock was going to fail. Northern Rock wasn't the problem. Northern Rock's business model was flawed because it was selling its mortgage book and then going back to the money markets to borrow more money. But no one was buying the books and no one was lending the money. So the bank had no money and everyone was drawing their money out at the same time. Well, if you'd ever run on a bank, it's going to be insolvent by the end of the day if everyone's taking their money out. And that's what happened to Northern Rock. They weren't the problem. It was the wider banking system that was the problem. It happened in America, not here. That's where the problems were. And it was too big to fail. There was the AIG insurance company had literally covered so many bets on so many CDOs and all these flash names for different derivatives. They were going to fail. So every country and every central bank stepped in, bailed them all out. And what did they do? Following March, they dropped the interest rate to 0.5%. Unprecedented. Now, what's that given me? That's given me confidence to think, well, guess what people are going to start doing now? Now the banks are being funded by the Bank of England. The Bank of England did a scheme called the Funding for Lending Scheme. They could lend money to banks at a preferable rate as long as they lent it out. Well, that was going to cause asset prices to rise. We could predict that. And we'd gone out and filled our boots. And the point I was trying to make is we bought a house in Ingram Road in 2008 for 100,000. 6 months later, nearly a year later, I bought a house in Skinner Street, exactly the same layout, for 60 grand and sold it for 87. So I just readjusted all my prices, filled our boots. We had one of the best financial times we'd ever had. Because
if you had to guess, what would it be worth today?
Doesn't matter, does it? Does it matter?
Well, if you'd held on to it, it might matter. But
why do I need to concern myself about that? I had the money out of it there and then. Got the money and yes, it might be worth.
And this is a fascinating other area where people often worry about what other people are doing. And in general, like the grass is always greener. And in property, people tend to look at other people's cash flow or they look at their profits that they take out on the way through.
Ideally,
you have your own strategy and your own plan and you stick to that.
But you hit the nail on the head there when you went to me. So what's it worth today if you'd have kept it? And what was my response?
Who cares?
Who cares? because that's not my strategy. I'm not looking, the grass is greener over there. Well, I wished I'd kept it. If I had kept every single house I'd purchased, wow. Be a different ballgame. But I didn't. I don't worry about that because there's no point in even thinking about it because it's not my bag. It's not my strategy. It's not my... I just think of the aggravation of holding the damn thing. And that's the difference between you and I. So I don't worry about... So it's easy to look at other people and compare yourself and think, well, they're doing that. Perhaps I should be doing that. Or perhaps I should... Well, and I see people changing strategies. I've got one strategy. It's very successful. And I stick to it. And I'm happy with it. One day, I'll be taking all the money and going, okay, I'm going to dump it into a block of flats, build a block of flats or buy a block. No funding, go to the council, here's the keys, rent them out to whoever you care. I don't care, just give me send me the money each month and I'll be done. But until that time, I'm not worried about it. Does that make sense?
Because it makes perfect sense.
It's not worrying about that someone else is doing better than me. I mix around with some extremely wealthy people, extremely wealthy. We're not talking about, you know, a couple of million. We're talking hundreds of millions of pounds. These guys I know, but you know, they do different to what I do. I don't sit there and think, oh, I should have done that. I should have done that. I wish I'd have done that. Or, oh, worry about, I should have done this. No, I am where I am. And that's the end of it. And that's, I live with that because my choices were very simple. Life is short, very short. You don't know when your time is up. I know that from my own mother. She passed at 23, for goodness sake, right? That reference point has led me to enjoy myself now. And that's what I do. So I don't worry about things unnecessarily. I don't do that because that is a complete waste of my headspace. Worrying about something that might not happen. But there's another one. I think we mentioned this earlier as well. Worrying about what people might think. That's a big one for people. They're afraid of what people might think. Now, when we did that resilience with you, I was quite open about a lot of things in my life. And someone said to me, yeah, but people might, so what difference does it make to me? And this is the key. I'm going to tell you this, right? If I bought you a gift, Will, I bought you a gift, right? It's a really nice gift. Here it is. And you say to me, no, Paul, I don't want that gift. And you give it back to me. Who does that gift belong to?
So belongs to you now, but thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, the thought was in the right place, mate. Much appreciated.
But so it belongs to me. So if I give you my opinion, Will, I think you're an absolute tosser. And you go...
I'll hand that back to you, Paul.
Yeah. If you say to me, what do you mean? You own it. You own it. You've just owned it. So if you say to me, as you said just now, I hand it back to you. I don't want your opinion. Thanks very much. You can keep it. Who does that belong to? Me. And that's what I'm like with other people's opinions. If they think I'm a dickhead, that's their opinion, right? And they've got the right to that opinion. And they could have all sorts of reasons why they think I'm a dickhead. But that's their problem, not mine. It's got nothing to do with me. What they think is irrelevant. Because I believe that... I remember the first time I ever got a negative review on my book. And it was quite a scathing negative review. It was really, you know, quite nasty. And I thought, well, that's their opinion. It was a woman wrote, that's her opinion. But the next one was a raving review. Well, hang on a second. These two people have seen something completely different. So that balances itself out because does it matter if it's a good one or a bad one? It's irrelevant. It's just someone's opinion. That's all it is. And they can't hurt you. People's opinions can't hurt you. Cannot hurt you at all.
Well, one of the things I've observed about you, Paul, is you're a great man for the cycling. What do you get out of it apart from the physical benefits?
Cycling?
Yeah.
Riding my bike.
Yeah, not just the writing, like you take it very seriously, your preparation, your what you do with the machine in advance and afterwards, and you seem to have a very structured way of approaching the whole thing.
Yeah, I think that comes from the way I felt as a child. Growing up, I had asthma, couldn't run 50 yards. My mum died of asthma as well, so it was something that I was aware of. I was the kid, and you're quite a sportsman, right? But I was the kid, if you was the team captain, you'd be thinking, I don't want ribbons on our team. I'd rather play without him than with him. He's that bad, right?
Oh, dear. Right? Oh, dear.
So I didn't get picked for anything. Right?
I was actually that kid, but I worked hard on not being that kid.
Well, here's the thing. I worked hard in my adult life not to feel the way that kid felt, because mm-hmm. I felt weak. I felt feeble. And I made a decision probably in my mid-20s to go to the gym before I went to work every morning. So when I became an agent, because in the baking trade, it was fairly physical. So I was quite reasonably fit in them days. Still had asthma. I still got asthma today. But I trained myself to say, okay, so I'm going to push through that asthma. I'll make sure it doesn't, make sure I've got my inhaler with me just in case. It doesn't affect me like it used to. But I control it, if that makes sense. But so I do it because I don't want to feel that way like I did as a child. So in my head, it's like, well, if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do something well. That's another thing that I think about, is if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it properly. What's the point in doing it half-heartedly? I'm a great believer in, we had a trip to the Alps in the summer. I think you've interviewed Jilly Barlow. It's her chalet. She lent it to me. And we were riding around them mountains. You know, we're talking some serious cycling there, serious bike riding. And I wanted to make sure I didn't suffer going up there. I didn't want to suffer. So I prepared for it. I worked hard. I trained hard. Because what's the point in suffering? You know, it's going to be hard enough as it is, right? Riding up a mountain, it's not easy. Mm-hmm. But then it's what it says about me as a person, the preparation that I put in, the hard work. I'm not a competitor. I'm not going to compete with you. I'm not a team sport person, but I'm going to compete with myself. And that's what I think about, is that I want to be better than yesterday.
Well, inspirational stuff. Paul Ribbons, the Resilience series continues. I'd encourage people to look back at the back episodes or to check Paul out on either YouTube or get in touch with him at paul@paulribbons.com. I'm Will Mellow. This is My Property World. Thanks again, Paul.
Cheers. Thank you very much indeed.
Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together, whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.